The city's fight with the school board could soon be settled. Investors buy up a couple of downtown Baptist church buildings and a celebration of the life of Jake Godbold. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Alyssa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories on our Friday roundtable, plus your calls. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, we're talking cattails with award-winning journalist and Florida author Craig Pittman. That's later, but first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Radio host Angela Spears of Angela Spears Communications is here.
Hi, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union back with us.
Hey.
And Shelton Hull of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
So good to have all four of you here. There's lots to talk about this week. So much went on over the last several days. Everything from a huge memorial for the late Mayor Jake Godbold to justice for a local man who was wrongfully convicted and some education and downtown development news all happening this week. But our top story right now, this Friday, the TU is reporting that three JEA bidders, NextEra Energy, Duke Energy, and American Water Works, are suing to keep the dollar amounts of their offers secret. All this as new documents recently obtained by the TU also show that JEA had a crisis communication plan in place that called privatization the only viable next step for the utility. This contradicts public remarks that the company made that it was just one of many options they were considering. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look. Give us a call with your questions and comments at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Nate Monroe, your colleague David Bauerlein is reporting that NextEra, Duke, and American Water Works have all sued together to try to block JEA from releasing the dollar amounts they were offering up to buy all or part of the utility. What are you learning?
Well, like, what a great group of guys we almost gave our electricity and water to, right? Like, so great that almost happened. They're contrary to promises that were made early on in this process that everything would be public at the conclusion of this invitation to negotiate. We are finding out that that's not as straightforward as it sounded at the time. Here we are, it's 2 months since privatization has been canceled, and we still don't have a lot of information that we were told we would be getting at some, you know, minute notes from negotiating meetings. The meetings were supposedly recorded. We have, like, none of that stuff. You know, we don't know how much some of these companies bid. I think there's just a real nihilism at JEA about the truth. You know, they said early on, yeah, sure, that'll all be public. And whether they knew that that was true or not, I don't think that they thought it mattered in the end, because they thought, you know, at this point, this train would be moving forward and JEA would be privatized and there'd be none of that stuff would matter.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call. What about the fact, Shelton, that the two of these energy companies, according to the TU, Duke and American Water, said the state sunshine law had exemptions that permitted them redacting this information?
Well, maybe they're right. Maybe they're not. These are bad people doing bad things, and they're doing the bad things badly. And, of course, it ends up in court. Only a crew like this could find a way to give electricity a bad name. Like, I want to do, like, wood-burning stoves now. I don't even want electricity after all this stuff they've gone through. I find it interesting that the one firm that is okay with having the numbers come out publicly is probably the one that put in the high bid. I would assume that these other companies don't want the information out there because they don't, probably to protect the mayor, because they don't want people to know that, number one, we never had a proper value assessed on JEA, and number two, a lot of these guys were putting in low bids for reasons that can only be speculated.
Mike Mendenhall, according to notes taken by the city's ethics officer, Carla Miller, NextEra Energy, their proposal would have brought the most money to the city with the sale of JEA. That's according to her notes. But the companies are suing to prevent that information from getting out to the rest of us.
Yeah, and then that means more legal bills for the city to fight this. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Macquarie, who had the largest bid. They actually have a presence in Jacksonville. So, I mean, you know, because they're local, I don't know if that was part of their thought process, as they have, you know, be open because we're part of the community, what, you know, what have you. But it was pretty apparent, at least to the public, that that it's invitation to negotiate, although they were being, you know, it was done in private, that all of these numbers should have come out at the end of it. And according to the Office of General Counsel, city attorneys are saying that as soon as the procurement process was killed, as soon as this invitation to negotiate was killed, those numbers should have come out. And that's what the city's arguing now.
Yeah. Right. It's 549-2937. What are your thoughts about the latest revelations into the scandal at JEA? Here is an email from Mark at Mayport Naval Station, Angela. It is critical we learn the amounts offered for JEA to discover if the valuation and economic outlook numbers given to the public were fraudulent. Follow the money. That is what the Jacksonville City Council Special Committee is doing, they say. That is what federal investigators say they will be doing as well, following the money trail of this whole affair.
And, you know, it's been estimated, you know, we've been told that possibly JEA was really worth more than $9 billion, right? When you're looking at everything that's coming out, the amount of money that it's worth, that we would have been losing money getting this. So I think you're right, Melissa. It's about following the trail, following that money to see what's going to come out of this. I think people are anxiously waiting on this. Some maybe not so much, Nate. Some people in JEA may be saying, let's not follow the money. Some of those bad guys, as Shelton is saying, may say, hey, we don't want to follow this money. Let's just end this right now, because everybody knows we were worth more. The company, our company, right? JEA's company was worth more. We weren't in this downfall that they claimed we were at the beginning.
Yeah, that
of this
was the other big revelation, that the financials at JEA were actually pretty solid, Nate. The TU also reported this week that there was a crisis communication plan in place at JEA that called privatization the only viable next step for the utility. Now, that completely contradicts what spokespeople for JEA were telling this program, other media outlets, for many months. We were told, all of us were told, it's just one of many options being considered.
Mm-hmm. You mean that something JEA was saying wasn't true? You know, what a crazy concept. That crisis comms plan, you know, I think it shows just how they viewed the community. Like, JEA considered an engaged and informed ratepayer to be a threat to this plan. I think they used the word problem. We don't know which of these stakeholders will end up being a problem, but it could happen. I mean, I think it gives lie to the comments that they had made about their commitment to exploring every option, and it does just reveal what a low opinion they have of the public.
You know, the advocacy group OurJax.com has weighed in on this recently too, calling this the worst public corruption scandal perhaps in the history of Jacksonville. Is that hyperbole to say, guys, or do you think that's a fair assessment?
I'd say that, you know, calling it the most, like, you know, the biggest public corruption in Jacksonville's history is like saying a thumb is a finger. You know, our city is sort of fundamentally corrupt, and this is part of it. I feel bad for these guys. You know, as a Floridian, I've been in on a few scams myself, but never anything like that. To be this close to pulling off a $10 billion scam of this scale, and to get so close and then fail, it must be just heartbreaking for all of them. And now this phase right now reminds me of the scene in Goodfellas where after they rob the plane, people are showing up with like fur coats on their wives.
The Lufthansa heist.
Lufthansa, yeah. And then they have to go mopping it up. So, I mean, some of these guys need to bundle up because it's cold outside.
Well, the difference between this and that is they actually did successfully carry off that heist.
That's true.
Mike Mendenhall.
Yeah, and you know, it's the financial information too that keeps coming out of JEA continuously refutes what the death spiral that we were told was happening. I think JEA released what's akin to fourth quarterly earnings recently and showed that their net position is actually almost or more than $200 million to the positive where it was the same time in 2018. You know, their revenues were up. And there are some different variables in there, you know, like fuel, the cost of natural gas was lower, those kind of things. But, I mean, any type of financial impact that JEA was facing was going to take a long time to materialize.
Okay, we are getting lots of Facebook comments about the top stories of the week, and we want your calls, too. It's 549-2937. Here is a comment from Susan. Rather than saying JEA, could you say Aaron's On, or the old JEA board that was appointed by Mayor Curry? It wasn't all of the workers at JEA who were part of this. Angela.
That's a good point that the person is making on Facebook, and you just have to, we really do have to just look at this and know who it is. Everything goes back to the top. Nate and I were just talking about this a few moments ago when we're seeing all these suits going in. People who I've been talking with, they really, really believe that somebody is going to go down for this.
That's the question we all have.
Who's going to go down? Who's going to go? Is someone going to get caught with this? Is there going to be enough paper trail for those at the very, very top to cover themselves? I don't know. But we do have to remember that it's not the workers out there. They're doing their job, right, to make sure that our services are there. We, as for those of us who have JEA as our electricity company, we want to make sure that our bills are in line with what it's supposed to be doing, that we're getting the services that we need. And we do have to keep that in mind about that. But and maybe we do need to say the old board. But if I were part of this, I wouldn't want to be part of the new board.
Should there be in criminal charges, call us up and let us know where you stand on that. It's 549-2937. Nate Monroe, I think that is the question anyone who's even casually following the federal investigation has. Will the feds indict anyone? Will we ever learn details of what they're probing? That's the question.
Yeah, I mean, we're just going to have to see. You know, public corruption cases are really complicated. They're tough to put together. They've become tougher to put together in the last decade. You know, they're out there. I mean, the FBI is actively interviewing people. There is work being done, but you know, it's kind of a fool's game to try to guess, you know, where they're going or what's happening with
that.
Yeah,
Nate already told me don't try to guess, Melissa. He already said, don't even try to put those pieces together of who's where, who's who. But people are talking about it, and they're trying to guess, and they're like, okay, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, and we're hearing so many different things.
Here's a comment on Facebook from Tom. A totally dishonest process. Carrie Stewart had me yelling at the radio every time she claimed they were pursuing five separate options. Has she resigned? He's referring to JEA Chief Customer Officer Carrie Stewart, who did say that on this program. Whether she was part of the crisis communication plan, whether she was in the loop on what was going on at JEA, we don't know. But if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we discuss the top stories of the week with Nate Monroe, Angela Spears, Mike Mendenhall, Shelton Hall, and yours truly, and your calls. Now, here is another big story from the week, and we want your calls on it. Duval County voters may get to actually vote on a half-cent sales tax for schools this fall. After all, new legislation will be presented at Tuesday's City Council meeting to try to place the referendum on the 2020 general election ballot in November, and basically to settle this dispute out of court. Let us know, do you want to vote on this half-cent sales tax referendum for local school repair and construction this fall? Do you want to see that on the ballot? It's 549-2937 to join us, Mike Mendenhall. If this is settled, it would be after almost a year of back and forth between City Hall and the Duval County School Board and a couple of expensive lawsuits, too, right?
Yeah, and you know, and a judge has ruled, although the city had decided to appeal, a judge had ruled that, you know, that the Duval County School District does have the right to hire an attorney to fight this. What's going to be interesting to see is when this legislation comes before City Council, is there going going to be a continued push as a legislation or from or rhetoric from a council member to fund to provide charter school funding in this half cent sales tax? You know, with everything that's happened in the last year between, you know, the pressure from the JEA issues to, you know, these lawsuits, you know, pending. Well, I mean, will there be a stomach for that, or will they just want to get it on the ballot and get it over with?
They may want to just see it, Melissa, just do it, get it on the ballot, just saying, hey, to see it as a win for the council members, because they really, really need something at this point. And you were talking about the charter school issue. Remember, we have to keep an eye at what's going on at the state level, right, with the charter sharing bill that possibly could pass, right, that says mm-hmm. that we'll have the referendum, that if there's a local referendum, that you'll have to share money, the charter school with charter school students, the public schools will have to share money with charter school students. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. But I mean, hey, it could just definitely be a win. The council could take it and say, let's just do that. I know I've been talking with school board members, and they're excited to get this on the ballot. Because Nate, who's been suffering? I'm sorry, Melissa.
Yeah. Nate Monroe.
The ruling on this issue about whether the school board had the right to sue the city, the fact that went the school board's way was a very big deal, because there is already an opinion in this judicial circuit that says, you know, the council or a county commission cannot unduly delay putting this on the ballot. And it's extremely unlikely that a judge in the same circuit is going to come to a different conclusion. So really, this question about whether the board had the right to sue, that was kind of the entire case. Mm-hmm. You know, the school board is the party that has the leverage, and it's telling that they have not changed anything about their plans, and the mayor has sort of come crawling on his hands and knees over to make a compromise. I mean, this... other than the date changing, this is the same exact plan that was apparently so unacceptable last year.
That's right. It's a real retrenchment by City Hall on this. What about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the mayor got himself spanked on the JEA deal. Now he's reaching for the ointment in the form of this legislation here. And I think it's really a win-win for everybody. Of course, as we go through the process, there's room for all kinds of shenanigans, but I would think that if you're City Hall, like, you would want to just put it on the ballot just to wash your hands with it. Like, they've taken enough hits. And of course, it's good for advocates for public schools, because you put on the ballot for November, there's a lot of activity coming later this year. There are things going on nationally that's going to bring a lot of voters out there. So if the sales tax referendum gets on the ballot, odds are pretty good that it will pass. And then that'll give the mayor an opportunity to say, well, yeah, there is some pushback, but then in the end, we stood back and the people had their way, you know. So it's a rare opportunity for a clean win.
And he can also say that it was a win, because he can say at the beginning, remember, he wanted this to happen this year anyway. Mm. So just take the win and just say, hey, sign it and just do it. And then our kids will win, because they've been suffering in the meantime,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
because
Mike,
this is what it's all about. It's our children.
Mike Mendenhall, these are really crumbling school buildings in places all over the city. Some don't have working air conditioning. Some don't have just safe infrastructure. And a UNF poll showed overwhelmingly the public is in favor of this way of raising money to shore up these buildings.
Well, I mean, what parent's going to want their child in a school where, you know, where the infrastructure is crumbling around them? I mean, to try you could have the best teachers in the world, but to try to learn in that type of an environment is incredibly difficult. And the messaging that's been coming from the mayor's office this time around too, it's interesting to watch, because the tone is completely different than it was last year. I mean, it was much more combative, much more last year trying to get the upper hand, and now it's, you know, we're working together, we're holding hands.
Here's a comment on Facebook. This is significant for Duval. We want to use an increase in our discretionary surtax to renovate neighborhood school buildings that are over 50 years old. We don't want to give the sales tax money to investors that own buildings housing charter schools that are less than 20 years old. This referendum will hopefully be on the November 2020 ballot. That's what the fight is about. Yeah. How much of this money will go toward charter schools rather than traditional public schools?
I think Tallahassee is going to answer that.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, we have to keep that eye, keep an eye on what's going to go, what's happening at the state. And Melissa, can I add in too, just to throw this little caveat in, that is it safe to say now, because, you know, maybe the mayor, the city council sees this as a win-win, safe to say that we're going to squash the superintendent being elected up at the state?
Yeah, that's a, that's another controversy that's floating out there, a bill that would allow Jacksonville to change its superintendent position from appointed to elected.
Yeah. So this could be dead because of this agreement or this.
And we want your calls here on the show. Join us. It's 549-2937. Mark is in Orange Park. Hey, Mark, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I wanted to say something about Mayor Jay Godbold. His ceremony was the other day.
Right. We were going to talk about that in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But anyway, if I learned anything from Snoop Dogg in the last couple of weeks, it was you shouldn't disrespect somebody who's recently passed. But, you know, ever since he passed away, I've been going through a lot of deep search headlines from the Times Union back when he was mayor. And, you know, we talk about growth all the time on this show. And this Jay Godbold, we are going to be cursing his name in 50 years because he was nothing but growth. I mean, I looked and looked and looked, and I didn't see anything where he was, you know, and he even remotely kind of holding back a little here, or holding back a little there, or maybe we shouldn't build that. He was nothing but build this. You know, he said, there was one article where he paraphrased that if we build it, they will come. You know, so mm-hmm. You know, he had a good life. He was I've met him a couple of times personally myself. He was an all shucks kind of guy, and you know, guy you want to have the beer with, and all those great things, but. You know, for some of the things that are confronting our city, like I said, in 30 and 40 and 50 years, we are going to be cursing his name as we sit in traffic and our kids can't go to good schools and the air is horrible. It's, you know, he's certainly not the only culprit in this, but he's a big link in the chain. So.
Okay, well, I wasn't planning to talk about that memorial for a few more minutes, but let's talk about it now. Jake Godbold, the late mayor, was celebrated in a huge ceremony at the Prime Osborne Convention Center this week. Thousands of people turned out and lauded his legacy, mm-hmm. a beloved figure in local politics. But what about Mark's point of view? Is his legacy more complicated?
Of course it's complicated, but the legacy of our city is complicated. The growth and the expansion of the city under his watch, you know, finances were different at the time. You could get things done for a lot less money and with a lot less hassle. The way downtown looks now compared to 40 years ago or even 30 years ago is dramatically different. A lot of that has to do with him. The ceremony yesterday was one of the real bipartisan moments in local history. It was great seeing all different generations and races, and even his even people who didn't like him were able to at least pretend that they liked him for a few minutes.
Yeah. And you know, as he pointed out, it's not considered good form to speak ill of the dead. I appreciate that. But, you know, this is a city that is dealing with sprawl and uncontrolled growth.
The context when Godbold was mayor was, like, completely different. And to say, you know, 50 years from now, to assess what Jake Godbold did in 1987 would be a little odd. I don't know that I fully understood that point.
Okay. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We had a little bug with our phone lines, but I think it's been fixed. So join us. Give us a call with your thoughts on the top stories of the week. It's 549-2937. Let's talk for a minute about another big headline from the week, justice for a local man who prosecutors say was wrongfully convicted. The attorney general here in Florida abruptly reversed their position this week, and they granted a petition to compensate Nathan Myers, a local man who spent 43 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. State Attorney General Ashley Moody now says it was wrong to deny reparations to Myers. Under Florida law, he was due this money. A judge last summer granted his petition for reparations for the time he wrongfully spent in prison, But Moody last month vetoed that court order. She overruled the judge, in effect, but then there was so much public pressure and outrage around this case that she reversed course on that. So for Myers and his family now, justice delayed, they always say, is justice denied. But good news for this Jacksonville man. Shelton Hall, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's good news for him, and it's good news for the process. You look at it, you know, from the local level up through the national level, you always hear people talking about the rule of law and trusting the process. And it's kind of holdovers from the 20th century. I think especially in the African-American community, there's never been any presumption of justice, particularly on matters like this. We've got people being, you know, some of whom are underage, people being run up for murders they didn't commit. Meanwhile, we've got hundreds of known murderers walking the streets, basically killing with impunity. So it's a good PR move, you know, with Miss Moody. I think it's similar to Curry with the school tax referendum. This should be an opportunity for her to say, yeah, I pushed back, but then eventually we stood back and the process played itself out and the people's will was done. There was, I'm not sure if it's federal law or not, but someone said something about if you're unlawfully in prison, you should get like $100,000 a year or something for each year that you were locked up. I think some type of like binding legislation from the federal level should be there to guarantee, you know, compensation for the wrongfully convicted so that there are no more arguments about things like this.
Right. I mean, no amount of money can truly compensate someone for wrongfully spending that many years in prison. Mike Mendenhall.
And that's very true. You know, you think 43 years in prison. I mean, this not only did this man lose out on, you know, potential happiness in his life, but also, I mean, you know, the loss of income over an entire of what could have been a career. Yeah. I mean, that $2 million, you know, may or may not be, you know, mm-hmm. what that could have equated to. So, I mean, the good thing that could come out of this, as Shelton was pointing out, is that it could set a precedent for other wrongfully convicted, you know, people around the country, and really, like, you know, if cases are overturned, you know, state AGs could really take a look at this and see, like, you know, well, we know where the mm-hmm. public stands now on yeah. this type of.
You know, at a national level, the Innocence Project in particular and the advent of better DNA technology has helped overturn a lot of wrongful convictions all over the country. And more often than not, they involve African-American men. And it's really astonishing the scope of this and how hard the Innocence Project has worked to bring justice to guys like Nathan Myers. And I think kudos, too, to the local state attorney's office for acknowledging that this was a bad call.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, what remains to me the most striking thing is how close these two were to staying in prison forever.
Yeah.
You know, that decision turned on an election because the city opted for a reform-minded person who, you know, set up the state's first conviction integrity unit.
Mm-hmm. And it's something, too, that we need to be happy that the process for this gentleman worked. And Melissa, like you said, there's so many people who, and unfortunately, it doesn't work for. So we have to keep up the fight and keep doing what we can. And hopefully this gentleman can find that potential happiness that he lost out on for all those years.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Linda is on the south side. Hi, Linda. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Both of us last two topics have something in conjunction. One is the public servant. The public servant of Ms. Ashley Moody, when you read the initial rendering, indicated that, you know, he wasn't entitled because he wasn't proven innocent. And our city council now hopefully allowing us to vote on the legislation, and yes, I want to vote, and yes, I'm going to vote yes. Hopefully we are getting some public servants out there, not just politicians. Politicians come and go, but people like Jed Gobble will be remembered forever because he was a public servant. Thank you.
Linda, thanks. I think that's why there was such an outpouring of emotion for Godbold this week. Here's an email from a listener. Such failed city leadership we're seeing during the funeral of the mayor who created what Jacksonville is today. The teardown of the landing symbolizes political force, the political force in charge at City Hall. We've seen roadblocks thrown in the face of a sales tax desperately needed to fund public schools. The potential sale of JEA, which was going to line the pockets of a politically connected few, such a fast track to riches. Mm-hmm. So he's touching on all the things we've been talking about today. Mm-hmm. The frustration the average voter out there feels with the leadership of this city on all of these controversies.
And Jake was one, Melissa, you know, he was one who to speak up. And he went out. I was talking yesterday with former mayors Delaney and Peyton, and I mentioned to them, I said, wow, Jake went out his way, didn't he? Mm-hmm. He went out on top. He went out fussing and fighting for the people.
He called into this program to talk about JEA just a month or so before he passed away, which was really remarkable. And 549-2937, Keith is on the west side. Hi, Keith. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How y'all doing?
Great, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Good. Excellent show this morning. Thank you for having it on. Hey, the thing about Jake Godbold, you know, I've heard it's pretty binary. You either love him or hate him. If you look at what he did, there's a strong case against Jake Godbold, but you have to admit, I mean, the man had charisma, whatever it was that kept him in office as long as it was. That aside, and I don't speak ill of the dead, this thing about a tax, another half-cent sales tax in Duval County for our upkeep of the schools, I'm strongly against that, and I'll tell you why. We added a half-cent tax for the bridge tolls a while back so that we could get rid of those toll booths that was blocking everybody's, you know, getting across the bridges, slowing things down, really creating a bad rush hour. When we still pay it. I mean, when we don't go across the bridges, we pay for going across the bridges. I might use them six times a year, seven times a year. I pay for them every time I buy coffee or a Coke or something else. This thing with the schools, there's money elsewhere that could be taken from, I don't know, other places.
Well, I hear you, Keith, but according to the superintendent and the school board, local and state laws prevent them from levying the money any other way. So what about that?
Well, then they came up a few years ago. They said you can either have gambling with a lottery, or you could have gambling with casinos. And they said, if it's lottery, we'll donate to the school fund, to the education of the schools in Florida. So we said, well, let's go with the lottery. The Florida voters did.
Sure. But the law doesn't allow for the lottery money to be used in this manner. That's the problem, is what I've been told. But Keith, I appreciate the call. I hear you, Keith. I want to get one more call on, though. Thank you, Keith, for that. Let me go to Marcus in Fleming Island. Go ahead, Marcus.
Yes, I was calling about the gentleman that was incarcerated for 43 years.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he is going to receive $2 million, that is absurd when you think about how much money he could have earned being free. And mm-hmm. how I think it was Ashley denied that original judgment is really absurd. I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you for that, Marcus. And, you know, again, State Attorney Melissa Nelson and her team did a courageous thing with this. I've heard rumblings that she may face an opponent over this case based on some in the community that aren't happy with what the state attorney's office did here. What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, you know, she could face some opposition. You know, the Jaguars play against football teams and we claim it's opposition, but no one's going to beat her. Like, no.
You don't see that being viable.
Someone may try, but I don't see anyone having the numbers to do so.
I don't see that happening.
Okay, and it's our Friday Media Roundtable. Let's take a few more calls on the top stories of the week. Jack is in Fernandina Beach. Hi, Jack. Hey, Jack. Jack, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Great. Go ahead.
Jack from Fernandina Beach. Two things. Number one, the way that they handled the sales tax business in Georgia about handling the schools, as they called it, a SPLOST, the special option sales tax, it was for like 1 cent on the sales tax, and it had a sunset provision where it went for 4 years, and if they wanted to renew it, it had to come up for another vote with voters to see if they wanted to continue it. And in the special option sales tax, the county or the government had to say specifically what the money was going to be used for. Project A, B, C, D, and E, and the estimated amount of funds to that project. If they were able to complete the projects before the 4 years was up, with the money that they had, the sales tax ended. You should consider that here in Jacksonville.
All right, Jack.
Secondly, I listen to the NPR station in Atlanta, and I listen to you guys, and from being down here 3 years, I have found out more about government in Jacksonville than I did the entire time I lived in Atlanta.
All righty then. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you for that. Yeah, yeah. We do our best to educate the public on everything that's going on in the community, Jack. So thank you for that, Jack in Fernandina Beach. Mike Mendenhall, what about his idea?
Well, there, I actually am familiar with something a little similar up in Iowa. It's actually a property tax that it's called PEPL, and what it does is it goes directly to technology and infrastructure for school districts, and then what they do is that it goes to the ballot every so often to renew that. I mean, there are other methods out there to fund the school infrastructure, and but it does become complicated when it's hard for the public to discern that there's a difference between the money that goes towards curriculum and education and what goes towards infrastructure.
Sure, yeah, it's complicated to follow.
This tax does have a sunset. It would last for 15 years, and if they wanted to be renewed, they'd have to ask voters to renew it. It is also a funding stream that is available to almost every other school district. Like, the Duval County school system is not asking for something extra. It's essentially asking for something that everyone else in the state of Florida has had for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, and so if someone's skeptical of that, then that's fine. But, you know, this is a low tax city and a low tax state. And, you know, we, relative to our peer Florida cities, you know, we pay less in taxes, and they have been kicking our butts in growth and quality of life measures for decades.
And I think bottom line is we need to remember what this is all about, right? The half cent sales tax. What is it about? Our children. And we've got to keep that in the forefront. It's about our children. It's about their education. And we want them to have the best here in our city.
And let me just say, in defense of our fellow NPR affiliate up there, up to the north, you know, really, the less you know about government in Atlanta, the better off you are.
Which is probably why he moved down here,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And he's learning all about our government.
That's right. Okay, another big story from the week. The First Baptist Church of Jacksonville sold two of its massive block of downtown buildings to a company that is going to build apartments there. Mike Mendenhall broke this story in the Daily Record. Of course, it was huge news a while back when the First Baptist Church announced it's selling off its downtown property, which amounts to a huge chunk of the downtown urban core. They're going to shrink down to just one building, basically. How significant is this news, Mike, that we're now learning these buildings, which were church buildings, will become apartments?
Well, it shows that there's interest by investors in this area. It could be a precursor to seeing what is going to happen on the larger nine blocks of property that are going to be sold now. And this property was actually on contract before the First Baptist announced that they were going to sell. So I mean, this has actually been in the works for a while, and it wasn't part of, it's not part of the nine blocks that they're marketing as one piece. So I mean, it just kind of shows that investors are interested in this part of downtown in particular, and one of the things that they told me is that because the city is investing in targeted retail in this area, and the DIA, the Downtown Investment Authority, is willing to make those moves down there, that it looks attractive to them.
Hmm. And we'll have to see what will become of the other buildings that are on the auction block. But there had been some discussion that maybe all of these buildings would be sold to just one buyer, but that's obviously not going to happen now.
Yeah, this is a huge opportunity for downtown to just do something with this gigantic dead space.
Right. It's a lot of property. And people, it's a big piece.
And people coming in, they're building more apartments. But then what are we offering, Melissa? We've got to continue to offer people to something to want to live downtown, right? Stores, shopping areas, you know, the attraction for Springfield for people. Why are they moving there, right? Look at that model to see what people are doing. Why are you moving into Springfield? Younger families, you know, so what's going to bring people downtown? You know, you hear different stories about whether or not people are really buying the apartments. And I know this one lady told me she lives downtown and she had to buy it sight unseen. And because they wouldn't let her in to see her building, but she just saw pictures. But she was like, okay, I just want to be downtown. But what are we offering people to move here?
The amenities, sure. And will these be affordable housing units, too?
Well, affordable, it's in the eye of the beholder. Yeah,
it's all
relative. You know, that particular area is primed for growth. So the people who invested, they're definitely going to get their money's worth. And it's good for the Baptists, too. You know, they've had a sort of a downturn in attendance and activity. And now with this little influx of cash, it gives them a chance to put the jellical back in evangelical.
Yeah. And these apartments, too, like for the investors say they are going to be market rate. So I guess, affordable, it depends on, you know, what the market says in that area. But one other thing, too, I did when I spoke with CBRE, who's the real estate agency that's marketing the remainder of this property, they said their strategy still is to sell it to one master developer. That's still kind of the strategy on the remainder.
All right. And before we let you guys go, it's time to look at the stories that might have escaped other attention this week. Yes, it's our lightning round. Okay, I'm going to start. I have two stories to throw out. Jacksonville has announced it will hire a chief resilience officer to coordinate the fight against climate change. Long overdue for this city. And then did you see that UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab put out a poll on where Florida voters stand when it comes to the presidential election? Mike Bloomberg beats Donald Trump by 6 points in Florida if the election were held today. Joe Biden by 1 point. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are tied with President Trump among likely Florida voters. Those are my offers for the week. Nate.
You stole my resiliency officer.
Oh, sorry.
I'm still wondering where the Lot J legislation is. The Jaguars had said at one point they wanted to break ground in March, and it's not, I mean, it'll be March and we still won't have any legislation for it.
Angela.
A couple things for me. LISC celebrated 20 years in the community of transforming neighborhoods. Last night at a community conversation, members with LISC introduced the Catalytic Projects, which is a portfolio of Jacksonville's next great big investment opportunity. So that'll be good to see. And have you seen, Melissa, the gentleman who wants, the president, Donald Trump, to pardon Corrine Brown?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? Follow that one.
That might happen.
Follow that one. Mike Mendenhall.
All right. A little plug for the Jacksonville Daily Record here. We're actually looking for Northeast Florida's top entrepreneurs. So if you know anybody who has a successful enterprise they've built from scratch, please send in your nominations. Go to jacksdailyrecord.com.
Will do. And Shelton Hall.
Not really a news story, but I just wanted to say at the Jake Godbold Memorial yesterday, we had the Jacksonville Children's Chorus. We had the Let's Ride Brass Band, Dr. Longinu Parsons, Jonah Pierre. It was a real nice display of the diversity of Jacksonville's music scene, which is growing and getting more attention nationally.
Absolutely. And thank you for that. Shelton Hall, Mike Mendenhall, Angela Spears, and Nate Monroe. Thanks for being here, everybody. We appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too. Up next, author and journalist Craig Pittman on the wild, weird battle to save the Florida Panther. That's coming up. Don't go away. Grandstand is on stage now at the Times Union Center for this weekend only. We spoke with star Jennifer Elizabeth Smith about the show.
About a group of World War II veterans who come home to Cleveland, Ohio, and it's not like it was before. It's not the happy ending they thought they would be coming back to, and they use music as a means of healing, and it's really beautiful.
Great show. Tickets for Bandstand at FSCJ Artist Series. Well, finally this hour, award-winning journalist and best-selling Florida author Craig Pittman is out with a new book, Cattail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. Pittman is on the line. He's en route to St. Augustine, where he will be the featured writer at tonight's Florida Heritage Book Festival Literary Legends Dinner. Craig Pittman, thanks for calling in. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so this book is all about the controversial history of the effort to save the Florida Panther. What interested you in this subject matter?
Well, I've been, as an environmental reporter for the Tampa Bay Times, I've been writing panther stories for about 20 years now, and every time I would write one, I'd think, wow, this would make a great book. There are fascinating, odd characters involved. There are lots of twists and turns in the plot. Things happen you don't expect, but I didn't have an ending, and you really can't write a book unless you have an ending in mind. Hmm. So about 3 years ago, I finally got a good ending, and I said, okay, now I can sit down and write this thing and tell people for the first time the whole story of how panthers became the state animal, very nearly went extinct, and were just barely pulled back from the brink by this sort of desperate ragtag band of scientists. It's just a great yarn.
Wow. I mean, we were down to a few dozen of them in Florida, right, at one point?
About 20, they think, and now we have about 10 times that. So it's a hopeful ending to the book, which I think you don't get a lot of sometimes with environmental stories.
Sure, and like so many issues that you cover, development is the issue, isn't it? The state's drive to develop really threatened this species.
It was a big part of it, yeah. And the other part being that the population had dwindled so small that they were suffering from genetic defects. And the veterinarian who discovered this was a woman, and a lot of her male colleagues and male superiors didn't believe it, and so she had a hard time convincing them of that. And so there's that sort of whole women in STEM issue involved in the book as well.
What would you say to those who are listening to this and they don't care about biodiversity? They would say, well, who cares if this species goes extinct? Why does that matter?
Well, for one thing, it's Florida's official state animal.
Right. Yeah.
That's kind of a bad look for Florida if your state animal goes extinct.
Sure.
But the other thing, too, though, is if you save the Florida panther, then you're saving sort of what makes Florida special, that the areas of wilderness that are unique to Florida and nowhere else. And it's a difficult balance because panthers are very wide-ranging animals, so they do need a lot of territory. But by saving what's important to them, you tend to save a whole lot of other stuff, too, smaller animals and plants and so forth that, again, are unique to Florida and don't exist anywhere else. Panthers are the last puma species east of the Mississippi. All the others have gone extinct. So this is sort of this last stand for a beautiful, charismatic animal.
Sure. Now, you're on your way over from the St. Pete area where you live to World Golf Village in St. Augustine for the Florida Heritage Book Festival, their Literary Legends Dinner. Tell me what's on tap for tonight.
Well, apparently I'm being named a literary legend in Florida.
How about that?
I keep saying allegedly a legend, or a legend in my own mind anyway. I have to tell you, when they called and told me that this honor that they devoted to give this honor to me, I had to say, do you have the right number? did you run out of all the other legends?
Hey, but you'll take it, right? Who would turn down being called a literary legend?
I'm sorry?
I said, why would you turn down being called a literary legend?
Not turning it down, just kind of surprised, because, I guess the thing is, that those last three letters end make you think that, he's done.
Yeah, it's like a lifetime achievement award, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, I've still got, ideas for four or five more books yet. You know, I'm not done yet.
Of course not. And I can't wait to hear more about them. But in the meantime, come on out tonight at 6 o'clock to the Renaissance Resort at World Golf Village as Craig Pittman, award-winning journalist at the Tampa Bay Times and New York best-selling author, is honored as a Florida literary legend. The new book is called Cattail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. Go to fhbookfest.com for more about the Florida Heritage Book Festival. Craig Pittman, thanks for all you've done to highlight these environmental issues so important in Florida, and have a great time tonight. Well-deserved kudos for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Palumbo is WJCT's news director, and our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. We always value your feedback. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in show, rounding up the biggest stories around the Sunshine State from the week. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.